Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all lines are on a listen-only mode. During our Q&A session, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone if you would like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I would like to turn the meeting over to Ms. Heather Howell. Ma'am, you may begin.
Hello and welcome to today's FDA webinar to discuss recent changes to the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments CLIA submission process. I'm Heather Howe, the Deputy Director of CDRH's Office of Communication and Education. FDA has established new processes for tracking submissions that require CLIA categorizations and is formalizing the dual 510K waiver by application program. To reflect these changes, we have updated the guidance document titled Administrative Procedures for CLIA Categorization, Guidance for Industry and FDA Staff. In addition, on March 21, 2014, we will update the internal electronic systems, which will affect the way in which submissions will be tracked. Today, the Deputy Director of the Office of In Vitro Diagnostics and Radiological Health, Don St. Pierre, will provide clarification on these changes and will answer questions following his presentation. Also with us today to assist with the Q&A portion of our webinar are several other subject matter experts from CDRH's Office of In Vitro Diagnostics and Radiological Health. Following the webinar, the slide presentation, audio recording, and written transcripts of today's program will be available on the CDRH Learn section of the FDA website. Now, I give you Mr. Don St. Pierre. Don?
Thanks, Heather. Okay, we'll try to get this going fairly quickly so that people can enjoy the rest of their afternoon without having to listen to me. Today, let me see, why is this popping up? Okay, so today we're going to go over the updates to the CLIA program. As I said, I'm the Deputy Director in the Office of In Vitro Diagnostic Devices, so I think probably many of you know me, and after today, many more will know me. So we're going to go over the background of CLIA for those people that don't have the history of that. I think most of the people online probably do. More importantly is what's going to be changing with CLIA and what it actually means for stakeholders. So that'll be our three main topics. For the background of CLIA, CLIA was proposed back in 1988 to establish quality standards for laboratory testing. And then those regulations were finalized in 1992. This is a program that is actually run by CMS, our sister agency, and FDA does just one piece of this for CMS, which is the CLIA categorizations. So in 1999, there was an FR notice transferring this categorization responsibility from CDC to FDA. So for the last 15 years, we've actually been it's kind of been a tri-agency effort with CDC, FDA, and CMS all kind of working together to do these CLIA categorizations. So it's actually, for having three different agencies with three different perspectives, it's really been an informative and really productive working relationship for the three agencies. So I think it's become a really good program and had a really good basis from its start with CDC setting up the how to go about categorizing products. In 2008, we actually issued two guidance documents. One was the Administrative Procedures guidance document for CLIA categorizations. This is the one that's the subject of today's webinar. But a separate guidance was on recommendations for CLIA waiver applications. So CLIA waivers by application get a special attention from FDA, I think, as most people know. So we kind of treat them a little bit differently because there's a lot of work associated with those, and they're not kind of the routine types of reviews that we do for other types of categorizations, either high or moderate or those products that are waived because of the regulation. So we're not going to be talking about the criteria for waiver, just the administrative procedures and the new IT systems that support those administrative procedures. And in 2012, we actually negotiated new user fees with the medical device industry, and as part of that, they wanted to include performance goals and other things related specifically to CLIA waivers by applications. So our administrative procedures have been updated to incorporate those discussions from those commitments from that user fee negotiations. So what gets categorized? Well, any device that, any IVD that FDA clears through the 510K process, approves through the PMA process, or an HDE process, or de novo process, so all of those products get categorized by FDA. Also, the same IVDs or similar IVDs that are cleared or approved by CBER or licensed by CBER, those also get categorized by the FDA. As well as, the, since this is, you're talking about CLIA categorization, which is a different statutory requirements, a different agency that we're actually doing work for, even though products that don't require a 510K review or a submission to FDA to get an FDA decision, they still require a CLIA categorization. So you could have devices that are exempt from FDA review that would still come in to get categorized for CLIA. And a thing that happens all the time, which I think this guidance document helps out a lot with if people actually use it, is when companies change names or change distributors and change labeling and stuff, a lot of times for IVD products, that can affect a lot of different products at once. And in the past, FDA had to do that one by one and enter those manually into the database on creating those records independently. We've now actually had a way, and we've been using this by policy, but it hasn't been written down anywhere, where we allow companies to actually submit a spreadsheet with all of those changes for all of those products so that all of them get loaded up into the public database rapidly and accurately. So that's been a big help for industry, and everybody that's used that has really liked that on industry side as well as FDA side. So, and of course, IVDs that are legally marketed for which sponsors are seeking a waiver categorization. So those are the waivers by applications. So how are IVDs categorized? Well, so you've got legally marketed IVDs, so they're either cleared or approved, they're licensed by biologics, or they're exempt, are categorized. The high and moderately complex devices, that's pretty routine, it's pretty standardized, is very usually, nothing novel or interesting about those. They're all based on an objective scoring system. We probably, over the 15 years we've been doing this, have maybe a handful of issues related to a high or a moderately complex categorization that we've done. Usually it's due to a misunderstanding. So either FDA got it wrong or industry presented it wrong. These are usually simple and easy things to resolve, so it's not a big deal. So that's not a part of the program that anybody really has many questions on as far as getting their categorizations. Those are usually right, and they're usually quick and never a problem. We also have products that are waived products. So there's multiple ways to get classified as waived. So you could be waived by regulation. So in the regulation, it cites 9 types of tests that are automatically waived. So FDA doesn't do a review of those to say, okay, this is waived or not. They're waived automatically, so you get the letter saying you're waived by regulation. There are other products that FDA either clears or approves that are for over-the-counter use, or more, a more common term is home use. So products that people can use in their home should not be that complex because people don't have the training to use to be able to understand complex systems for those products. So if you can use them at home, then they should be pretty simple. So those are also automatically waived. So if it's one of the 9 cited in the regulation, it's waived. If it's cleared or approved for home use, it's waived. Those things happen automatically. The one that doesn't happen automatically is the waiver by application. So, and that's the one that is the subject of that second guidance, which we're not going to be talking about today. Devices that companies submit and request waiver by application, those require clinical data. That's a whole separate review, and it kind of takes on the kind of the persona of kind of like an FDA review of a 510K or a PMA. It's kind of more PMA-like because the data requirements are a lot more onerous for a CLIA waiver than they would be for a 510K or such. It's really important to understand because I think industry sometimes has the misconception that if they demonstrate substantial equivalence, that should be good enough to also demonstrate waiver. And they're two different animals, and they shouldn't be confused, and they shouldn't be associated with saying, you know, what one gets you the other, because it certainly isn't the case. So what is changing? One, we have administrative tracking mechanisms. Those are coming about because of MDUFA commitments that came out in 2012. In addition, we're updating our CLIA administrative procedures to provide some of the other things that we basically have learned since 2008 to document how we're actually doing things today, and also to provide that opportunity for people to make multiple changes by submitting a spreadsheet of all those changes rather than having the FDA and the sponsors do them independently. So what's changing or what's about to change? So in 2012, FDASIA, or which was MDUFA user fee negotiations, were part of FDASIA, and industry wanted some commitments on FDA's part for CLIA waivers by application. So it's not the high complexity issues. It's not the moderately complex categorizations. It's not the waivers by OTC or home use. It's not the waivers by regulation. It's that very small subset of CLIA waivers by applications that industry was hoping to have performance criteria established around. So, excuse me. So that's kind of one of the major drivers of the new IT system, as well as another thing that came out in the MDUFA negotiations, which was being able to do a dual submission, which is actually doing a 510K and a waiver by application in the same submission at the same time. So, which is a totally new and different process than we've used previously. So in 2012, we started implementing these commitments for CLIA waiver by applications. It took us about a year and a half to develop a new IT system to kind of track and report on these commitments. It's important to understand that CLIA waivers and CLIA reviews and categorizations are totally separate from FDA decisions, because the CLIA comes out, those decisions come out under with respect to the CLIA statute in CMS versus the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act in the FDA. So they're totally different animals. We've kind of tracked since getting this program in 1999, we've kind of tracked everything through the FDA submission. So that makes it really complicated because you can have tons or hundreds of CLIA applications or changes that relate to CLIA categorization for each 510K or each PMA. So it's hard to kind of track them under one tracking number. So this new IT system basically is allowing us to track all of our CLIA work and anything related to CLIA separately from all the FDA work, which is the 510Ks and the PMAs, but it links the two systems. So we'll still have that linkage, and everybody will still be able to see that linkage and know what that linkage is, but we'll be able to track each individual CLIA categorization action that we take. So starting March 21st, fingers crossed, the new IT system will be implemented for CDRH. And this will have all this new tracking system for the CLIA work that we do. And that new IT system will not only track each individual CLIA activity that we do, it'll also it's also set up to monitor and track our performance as we negotiated in 2012. So all of those things are tied up into this new CLIA administrative procedures guidance, and it talks about it introduces some new language or a new tracking system that will be that industry will see as well as everybody else will see, because this tracking number will be in the public database. So not a great worry for anybody per se, but anytime something new pops up and people don't know what it is, it causes questions. So hopefully we'll be able to answer all those questions today. So what is changing? So here we have, again, I kind of went through all of this. These are the different types of CLIA categorizations, the things that we do. So it's devices that are approved or cleared by CDRH, devices that are approved, cleared, or licensed by CBER, devices that are even exempt from FDA review but still need CLIA categorization, and then all of those changes after a product is out in the market, all those product name changes or distributor changes or company changes, all those changes that come in, as industry would see, as add to files to either a 510K or amendments to PMAs, all of those things will now be getting a CR number, which is a CLIA which we refer to as a CLIA record. So starting March 21st, companies will be getting when they submit their 510K, PMA, or de novo application, where those are basically the parent documents as far as CLIA is concerned. So when they submit those, you'll get your acknowledgement letter for your 510K, PMA, or HDE, or de novo application, just like you normally would. But you'll also be getting a separate letter saying that we've also assigned a CLIA record number to this application. So you'll get separate communications for both of those. Same happening to any submissions submitted to CBER. Same for submissions that are exempt and there is no parent document, so there is no 510K or PMA number. You'll just get a CLIA record number. So that those X files that we created for exempt files, those are kind of basically dummy documents for us just to have something to track. There was never an FDA submission associated with that. It was just for the CLIA. So now we'll just have a CLIA record number, which is a lot cleaner. And then, of course, when companies submit add to files, those add to files will get logged in as a CLIA record. So if you are changing the device name and you submit an add to file to a 510K, we're not asking you, the companies, to do anything different. It's just that's going to get logged in and be assigned a CLIA record number, a CR number. So we also have here the CLIA waivers by application. So this is that very small subset of applications that we get, maybe 10 or 12 a year. Expect that will eventually go up, but right now it's probably averaging about 10 or 12 a year. So for those particular devices, they're going to be handled in a similar way, but they're going to be given a CW number. So these are CLIA waiver by applications. Because these require a substantial review of data and a specific application that the company submits to us with all these data to support waiving their product, then that's kind of giving a different number, since MDUFA actually asks that we track and report out on these. We've given a separate designation so that these are easily identified in the database and can easily be pulled out. So it's the same thing. They're still all going to be associated with a parent document, so whether it's a 510K, PMA, BLA, what have you, it'll have those parent documents. except for, of course, if the device is exempt from FDA review and there is no parent document, there is no submission, then it'll just get that CLIA waiver CW number. So all that's coming into play starting on March 21st. So the other thing with the tracking system, so it's not only to capture all of our CLIA work and all of our CLIA waiver by applications, it also captures a new program that was started with FDASIA or MDUFA 3, which allows companies to submit a dual application, so for their 510K and a CLIA waiver by application. Prior to this, companies had to get their product cleared or approved or licensed by FDA and then do the CLIA work. So because you had to have a legally marketed product, so you had to do the FDA piece first to make it legally marketed, and then you did the CLIA piece. Well, this allows companies to do their 510K and their CLIA waiver studies all in one application. It was kind of important to industry because they were like, if their product is not waived, then it's not a real viable product. So they needed the waiver was very important, and it was as important or more important than the FDA clearance or approval. So for those subset of documents where that's important, that they both happen at the same time, then this is an added option for those companies. This is a difficult process, and we've piloted this before, and it is difficult because the applications kind of feed off of themselves. So if you make changes to your FDA document, your 510K or PMA, that could impact the information or the studies that you need for your CLIA waiver application. So it's very difficult to do this unless you set it up well from the beginning, which is why in the MDUFA commitments we made the doing a pre-submission mandatory, because that's the only way to kind of that's the best way that we knew how to try to guarantee success or make success more possible. Because without that, we don't think these would end up in a positive state. So we'll go over that a little bit more later. So what the MDUFA 3 has done is it set up performance goals for CLIA waivers by application. So, and the slide shows what those performance goals are. These performance goals, although have never been really applied to CLIA categorizations before, again, because CLIA we're doing that for CMS and it's not like an FDA responsibility for, clearance or approval. So, what we did was to devise similar performance goals as for the FDA part of our work, even though CLIA has never been associated or has never been tracked that way. We kind of adapted that system because industry actually understands what the MDUFA goals are. That makes sense to them. The process makes sense to them. So might as well have CLIA categorizations use the same process. So talking about the dual CLIA waiver, dual 510K and CLIA waiver by application, this has its own separate performance goals, and there are requirements. So you have to actually have a pre-submission. So when you submit your 510K, you should be identifying the pre-submission that you had, that you worked out the plan with FDA on how you were going to go about doing this to improve your chances of being successful at the end. And we have our performance goals that are associated with this. They're a little bit longer because basically FDA is doing two reviews. We're hoping that at some point the two reviews will merge into one, but quite frankly, that's probably idealistic because because the studies required to obtain CLIA waiver are so much more burdensome than the studies required to demonstrate substantial equivalence. So because of that, you know, it's probably why we were thinking that this would be limited to that small subset of products that are not really viable if they are not waived. So if it's not one of those in that small subset of products, then you're probably better off getting your FDA decision and then doing your CLIA, because at least you have something that you can market and you can make money on your marketed product, and then you work on getting your CLIA waiver by application in addition to that. And to provide greater transparency during the MDUFA negotiation, we said we would update our procedures to kind of make this new review and management expectations clear for waivers by applications and the dual process, because these are all new not only to industry, but they're also new to the FDA staff, having these performance goals, meeting these certain expectations. So that's an entirely new animal for FDA staff, and being tracked on these performance goals for these types of submissions. So updates to the guidance document. The guidance document explains what a CLIA record or CR number is and when it'll be assigned. It includes time frames. It includes instructions for submitting these requests to FDA, as well as the multiple categorizations. And I would like to highlight this because this is a huge time saver for industry, and it's a huge time saver for the staff here because it allows them to enter multiple records, whether that's 100, 200 different records all at once, rather than creating and going into 200 separate records and creating those documents. So this is a huge time saver. The benefit for industry is your actual categorizations that are in the public database actually happen a lot quicker if you do this, because it could take a long time for FDA to enter all of them in. And the guidance document talks about the CLIA waiver numbers or the CW numbers that will be assigned, and what those expectations are of staff and industry for actually making that process happen smoothly. So expectations for CLIA waivers by application: the submission should be sent to CRH. You should still be referencing your CLIA or approved product, or your 510K or your PMA, because you have to basically demonstrate that you actually have a legally marketed product. And, you know, I think industry, although the e-copy program had its trials and tribulations very early on, I think a lot of those things have been worked out, and this has been working much better now. Since everything has, all the FDA documents pretty much have to come in through e-copy, it wasn't something that we negotiated in the MDUFA 3 negotiations, but since companies know how to do this now and it does expedite the process, it's well to your advantage to actually submit your CLIA waiver by applications via an e-copy. If you did it for your FDA submissions, you should know how to do it for this. And when you do that, FDA will send you an email or correspondence assigning you your CLIA CW number, the tracking number, and that's the number that you would refer to in future conversations with FDA, and that's the number that FDA will use. Again, our database will link this to the 510K or the document. So for these types of submissions, FDA is going to do its initial review within 90 days and either request information and put the file on hold or just interact with you thinking that you've done such a great job, we'll be able to get this done in that one cycle and one round and complete your application. And at the end of that, hopefully get your waiver granted. FDA So once you submit that information, it'll come in as a CLIA waiver supplement. So it'll be a CW with, X, you know, what is it, six numbers, then a slash with a supplement one or however many supplements it takes to get it done. And then at the end of that process, so by day 180, you're going to get your decision on that waiver application. It's either going to be granted or it's going to be denied. So right now I think we're probably running 50-50 for the ones we grant and the ones that we deny. But I think companies that actually go through the pre-submission process and work with FDA up front and setting up their protocols and understanding what's actually required to get CLIA waiver, those companies tend to do better during this process. So once we make that decision, we post that decision in the CLIA public database saying that the waiver has been granted. So that's kind of what industry is looking for, to have that in the public database so that everybody knows that the product has been waived. So for a dual application, this is one where you must have a pre-submission. So you must have done the pre-submission ahead of time. And then you'll reference that pre-submission in your 510K. And that 510K will contain not only the data and information necessary to get substantial equivalence, it'll also need to contain all the information for the CLIA to get CLIA waiver. So all that information has to be in that application at that time. There's no staging of the information. There's no, okay, well, I'm submitting my 510K now. I'll give you the waiver. And I wanted this to be a dual, but I'll give you the waiver information later. None of that. It has to all be in that submission at the time you submit it. And this, because of coming in as a 510K and a waiver application, this is subject to e-copy, so these actually have to come in an e-copy. So when you do this, we're actually going to assign two numbers. So we're going to give this a CLIA waiver number and a 510K tracking number. So that way we can capture and track performance on both our 510K performance as well as our CLIA waiver performance. And it's important for these particular applications to have kind of independent tracking. Hopefully all these tracking dates and numbers will all be the same because they're being reviewed at the same time. But it's a possibility that there could be some differences there. So for these types of applications, it's coming in as a 510K, so we're basically will be following our refuse to accept policies for 510K and such. So FDA will complete our substantive review of this within 90 days, and again, either put it on hold, asking for additional information, or say that we think that this is done well enough that we can get this done in one round with the company at the end of that. Or if you don't hear from us at all, then you'll get what you'll hear is that your SE and your waiver is granted. So, okay, let's be honest. The likelihood of that happening is not great, but it is a possibility. So if we ask for additional information, then that information will come in as a, you'll submit that information as a supplement. And then within 210 days, this is longer than just an FDA 510K review, because we're basically doing a review of both types of things at once. So we extended the days out a little bit. So by day 210, you'll get your decision. So that'll either be your SE and your waiver is granted, or your NSE and your waiver is denied. So it's better to get the first one. So and of course, if you are SE and your waiver is granted, we'll post that in the public database. So update to the guidance. Really, there's no changes to the scientific review process. So, like I said, the scoring mechanism to get your high complexity, moderately complex, or wave categorizations, those are all stay the same. The criteria to get your CLIA waiver by application, that is all outlined in that separate guidance document. So that's not the subject of this webinar. So even if you're not doing a CLIA waiver or a dual submission and you just want to do a CLIA waiver or something, you can still submit, do a pre-submission, and actually we would probably recommend that you do that to get feedback on what studies you're planning to do and your protocols for your to support your CLIA waiver. So I think it really is a good idea to do that. We've gotten a lot better in our pre-submission interactions, and it seems our industry really likes that, and those things are going better than they have, you know, many years ago. I don't think we actually did a great job with our pre-submissions. Now it's a much more standardized process. There's clearer expectations of what to get out of them. So I think if you haven't done a pre-submission in the recent past, then you may want to give it a try. It does allow great interaction between FDA and the sponsors, and it can be multiple interactions. So it sets up that dialogue between FDA and the companies, which is important. So what does it mean for stakeholders? So we're going to talk mostly about industries, sponsors of these applications, but also there will be some changes that the clinical labs and CMS will see or auditors, CMS auditors will see. So we'll go over those. Sponsors will receive a pre-market tracking number, so kind of like they always have. You'll get your 510K number, you'll get your PMA number, you'll get your acknowledgement letters, but you're also now going to get a separate an email with a separate tracking number, and that will be your CR number. So you'll get separate letters for each of those. It's important to recognize that if you're submitting your 510K, you don't have to request this number. You don't have to do anything. FDA is doing it all, and you're just going to get the two numbers. So it's like you're getting a twofer. If categorization is not needed, so there are some applications that we don't do categorization for, calibrated and controls, and certainly if we don't clear you, we're not going to categorize you. You'll receive an email closing out the CLIA record, which we created, saying that we're not categorizing this product, this site, that you submitted under that 510K. If it is needed, you'll receive a letter, again, by email within 10 days of the marketing decision. So if we clear your product, so we give you your SEE letter, then 10 days late, within the next 10 days, you should also be getting your CLIA categorization. And of course, the CLIA categorization will show up in the CLIA database, which is the public database. And in that database, it will also show what the parent was. So it will associate that 510K, PMA, HCE, or whatever it is with that particular CLIA record. So hopefully all of this will be automated by automated email, so it should be pretty streamlined. Very important that you have correct email addresses in all of your submissions to FDA. So same thing for a little bit different procedure. So if you're submitting an application to CBER, So whether it's a biological 510K or a BP or you get a, or it's a BLA, CBER will do their review. And when they finish their review, if they come out with a positive marketing decision, then they're going to send that, automatically forward that information to CDRH, and we're going to categorize, and we will issue you a CR number for that. Again, nothing for industry to do here. CBER's going to do this. Only thing for you to do is be aware that this is what is happening, and if you don't get a CR number from us after your BK is cleared or your BLA is approved, if you don't get that, then you should send FDA an email asking why you didn't get your CLIA record number. This is kind of a new process that we're setting up, so I don't expect it to be 100% from the get-go. So totally understand. If something's happening that you don't understand, just send an email and ask the question. Pick up the phone, ask the question. Not a problem. For these types of applications that either come from CBER, there'll probably be a little bit of a time lag, but we would get these out within 30 days. It may be a lot sooner. We'll just have to see how this process goes, because this is really a new internal process for us. So I think it'll probably be better than 30 days, but we have to start somewhere. So if your device is exempt, before you got that X number, you won't get an X number anymore. You're just going to get the CR number. And if your request for CLIA categorization is complete, then you're good to go. But if you're like missing your package insert, which is what we use to categorize and make most of our categorization decisions, or if your device isn't legally marketed, then you'll get correspondence from FDA closing the CLIA record file, so we won't be having anything to review, but we'll tell you why we're closing it and what you need to do. So otherwise, if your CLIA record is complete and we have everything that we need and it's appropriate to do that, we'll issue your categorization within 30 days of receiving that information from you. Again, there's no, because your product hopefully is already cleared or approved, there's no FDA review part of the review going on. It's just the CLIA categorization. So these are the ones we're talking about, either the exempt files or those add to files or things that are for submissions that are either don't need to be submitted to the FDA or have already been submitted to the FDA and cleared or approved. So, again, these will all show up in the public database with a CLIA record number, a CR number, as well as the 510K or PMA number. So it's very easy for everybody to pick out whatever number they want. So since most people are used to the 510K, seeing the 510K numbers and the PMA numbers in the database, although we don't think we necessarily need them there, we're leaving them there because that's what people are used to. If you want to correspond with FDA related to something that's in the CLIA database, we would strongly recommend that you correspond with us and providing us with the CR number or the CW number, because that relates to an individual, a specific application to FDA, whereas if you just gave us a 510K number or a PMA number, that could relate. There could be 100 different categorizations that are related to that specific parent document or that specific application. So it may take us longer to find it. So you'd be much better off if it's something that relates to something that's in the CLIA database, referring to the CR number, because it's a much more specific number, and we'll be able to locate it quickly, and we'll be able to provide assistance in a much more rapid manner. So, again, if your 510K is cleared, your PMA is approved, and you're just submitting an add to file or an amendment to your PMA, those will get CLIA record numbers and will correspond with you related to that CR number. Again, if your submission is missing the package insert or it's missing information that we need to actually complete the CLIA record, we'll let you know that, and we'll tell you what we need or why we didn't do it. And if it is complete, you'll get your categorization letter via email, and we'll publish that information in the public database. For CLIA waivers by application, again, we'll send you an acknowledgement letter so that you know that we have it, and that we're reviewing it. It's basically in our hands, so no black hole for CLIA waivers. If additional information is needed, you'll hear from us by day 90, either putting the file on hold or quite possibly maybe not putting it on hold. But if FDA does put the submission on hold, you're treating this the same as your FDA documents, your 510K or your PMA. You're submitting the additional information to the Document Control Center, and they'll log it in as a supplement to the CW number. So within 180 total FDA days, you're going to receive a decision from FDA. So it's going to be granted or denied. This will be by an email. So hopefully with all this automation that's coming in with all the new IT systems that we have, all of this stuff will work out pretty smoothly. If we do grant your waiver application, again, it'll show up in the public database with your CW number, but it'll also still have your PMA or 510K number. So what does it mean for industry when it comes to the new dual 510K or the CLIA waiver by application process? Well, so if you're doing this dual submission type, again, it's important that you have a pre-submission. If you don't have a pre-submission and you ask for the dual, we're going to say you don't qualify for dual. We're still going to review your 510K. We're still going to review your PMA, but we're not going to review the CLIA piece until we finish the FDA piece. So if you have a pre-submission and you submit your application and you're designated as a dual submission, then we're going to treat it as a single submission. It's kind of like, think of it as like the de novo process. It's a whole separate application type. De novo isn't a 510K, it's a de novo. Dual submission is not a 510K, it's a dual submission. It's a 510K and a CLIA waiver. That's a entity in and of itself. So I think of it as a separate entity or separate submission type. And again, these cannot be staged or modular. You can't give us one piece and say you'll give us the other piece later during the review process. It's got to all be in the application when it comes in the door. And unlike other CLIA categorization requests, the duals, because they're coming in with an FDA document, must come in as a new copy. So if your application is successful, you're going to get, when you get your application, you're going to get two acknowledgement letters, one saying that we received your CLIA waiver, one that we received your 510K. But even though you'll get the two separate letters, we're actually conducting the review under one review clock, and we're doing just the one review. Because this is coming in as a 510K, we're applying all of our, pretty much all of our 510K rules to the application. So if so, we're doing our refuse to accept. Again, if a company, if your submission is rejected, you'll submit your additional information to the Document Control Center. You'll send it into the supplement, referencing both the CW and the 510K number. The review clock resets to zero, and we start. Hopefully, we accept the 510K, and the review will start on both the CLIA waiver and the 510K review. So after the next kind of review milestone is the substantive review. So we do that by day 90. So by day 90, you'll get an email that either puts the submission on hold, asking for additional information. You'll submit that information to the Document Control Center. It'll get logged in with a supplement number when you do respond, and it's going to get a supplement number for both the CLIA waiver and the 510K. So within a total of 210 days, not 180, but within a total of 210 days, you're going to receive one of two outcomes. Either you get SE and you get your waiver approved, or you get NSE and your waiver is denied. If it's approved and you're waived, then, of course, that information will go in the public database. So pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Important to recognize that you're not submitting anything new or different to the FDA. These are all internal processing stuff for the FDA to create these new tracking numbers so that you can track your CLIA submissions or the CLIA stuff separately from the 510K or PMA stuff. Again, clearly, when you're talking to the FDA about FDA work, you should be referencing your 510K and PMA number. When your questions are related specifically to the CLIA work or the CLIA categorization, you should be referencing your CR or CW numbers. So what does it mean for the lab community or for CMS? So the only real impact on them, the only thing that they're going to see, is the changes in the CLIA, in the public database. So the public database is going to have a new tracking number associated with it. So they're going to see these CW or CR numbers. They're just going to know that that's an FDA tracking number assigned to track FDA work. It doesn't really actually have any impact on the labs or CMS, but, of course, seeing something new, they'll be wondering what it is. So if you're in a clinical lab or CMS on the phone, it's an FDA tracking number or tracking association. You don't have to worry about it. And please don't worry about it, because these are tracking systems. This tracking system is going from March 21st forward. We're not changing or creating CLIA records for all the documents that are in the tracking system already. So there will be all that legacy data that won't have a CR or a CW number, and it has no impact. It doesn't mean anything. It just means we weren't tracking them that way previously. So should have no impact, so people should not be worried about seeing this new number. But what it does do, because probably the three questions that we get most related to CLIA is I can't find my CLIA record, or I can't find my CLIA categorization in the public database, or my CLIA categorization is not in the database. So those are the two biggest questions. This will be much easier for us to find what those records now. But the third largest question is actually, how do I get my CLIA certificate of waiver? And, of course, we only do the categorizations. You want a certificate of waiver for your laboratory, then you still go to CMS. They've got a great website with all that information on there. So if you need your cow or a certificate of waiver, you go to CMS for that. FDA just does the CLIA categorization. So we just say whether it's high, moderate, or waived. That's all FDA does. So here are your references for information from FDA, that all the information that pretty much we would have that's public related to CLIA. Probably should have put up here CMS's website, because they own the CLIA program, and they do a really good job with it. So any questions outside of CLIA categorization should be going to CMS. Thank you for participating in this website, in this webinar. If you have questions at any time, if you don't get to ask them today or we don't get to answer them today, we have set up an email that is going to be monitored by multiple people in my office. So that's the CDRH CLIA coordinator. So any questions that you have, you can just send to this email address and somebody will get back to you. So hopefully that will reduce some of the anxiety with anytime FDA makes changes, tends to cause some anxiety. This shouldn't cause anxiety. FDA is pretty much doing all the work, and the questions and the issues that you have when you ask FDA a question, you'll have a better way to better identify what you're asking your question on, so FDA will be able to provide that help more rapidly. Thank you very much.
Okay. We'll take questions from anybody on the webinar at this time. Please indicate that you have a question, and the operator will indicate that it is your turn to ask your question.
And to open questions on your phone, please dial star 1 to ask a question and record your name. Thank you. I'm not showing any questions queuing up on the phone currently.
Wow. Love it. Everybody wants to get home. Okay.
Okay. Well, this is Heather Howe again, and I thank you for your question, or actually that was a written script, so there wasn't a question today. Please, as Don indicated, let us know if you have questions in the future at the email addresses indicated on your screen right now.
Excuse me, Ms. Howell. 3 questions just popped in.
Oh, wonderful.
So the first question is from Susan. Ma'am, your line is open.
Yes, I just wanted clarification. On the dual review, you said that there were 2 options, an SE and waiver or an NSE and waiver denied. Is there also the option of an SE with the waiver denied?
So that was not the way that it was intended to happen, but probably I would say FDA, being who we are, we probably would not withhold an SE determination if the product was SE. So we probably wouldn't do that. I think that's what it ends up for an industry's perspective is it would end up taking you a lot longer to get that SE decision in the end. So it's probably not a good, it's probably not good to think, well, I'll do them both, and if I only get one, then at least I'm getting one. It's going to take you a lot longer to get the one. So I think you should use a dual program, again, if you need that waiver to actually make your product viable. I think that was what the intent was for that. I think if you use it for something a bit other than that or something more than that, I think it's probably going to be disappointing because it's not a easy thing to do. So we'll help you out with it as much as possible, but the likelihood of success for that is clearly not as good as if you just submitted a 510K or a waiver application separately.
Understood. So, I just would hate to start the 510K if we had made it that far.
We wouldn't do it to you. We might want to, but we wouldn't do it to you. I can't imagine.
And then
you've met the statutory criteria, so I don't think legally we would be able to not SE you.
All right. And then on the additional information, if that's required, that follows the same time for a response, the 180 days, as is for a 510K?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
And our next question comes from Q-Ann Kim. Ma'am, your line is open.
Hi. My question is for dual submission. The FDA reviewer would be the same person or a different person is assigned for CLIA waiver and 510K?
So it would be the same person, but they might set up different teams to do different aspects of the review. But it would be you'd be interacting, unless there was a huge workload issue and it could be handled more efficiently a different way. I would say 99 times out of 100, it's going to be the exact same person doing both.
Thank you.
And the next question comes from Marlene Hanna. Ma'am, your line is open.
Thank you. If a manufacturer has a product that's categorized and in the database, but we no longer support that product, do we need to send in a request to have that removed from the database?
You don't have to send in a request. If you do send in a request, I'm not sure that we would actually update the database. That might be a good, not helpful to have outdated information in a public database, but I'm not sure there's a way to actually update that database appropriately. One, we'd have to validate, make sure that you're actually the person that actually has that submission now or has responsibility for that submission, because we wouldn't want companies sending in stuff deleting other people's submissions. So there's probably a lot of validation that would go along with doing that. But if you send that question to the CRH CLIA coordinator email, we can look into that more specifically. But to my knowledge, I don't think that we update that database to remove stuff that is not that companies are no longer marketing. I know we don't do that for the 510K database or whatever. So I don't think we would do that either for this public database. Not that it wouldn't be a good thing to do.
Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from Katara. Ma'am, your line is open.
Hi, yes, this is Katara Calleja. Thank you, Don, for an excellent overview and on the program and the MDUFA commitments that have been associated with it, and particularly with the dual program. I had two questions. The first is related to as a company goes through the pre-submission process, puts together that submission, my understanding is that option under the MDUFA commitment is available to all manufacturers, that the guidance will be provided to the company, but I just wanted to clarify that option for dual submission going through that process allows a company that option. You talked about success and that it can be challenging, but I just wanted to clarify that is an option to companies. And my second, because I think that's vitally important, we talked about a small subset of products. I think in many cases in this particular area, the companies simply are the CLIA waiver is so critically important to the submission that, as you mentioned, the whole intention towards bringing the product is for the ability to have a CLIA waiver. So I think that dual program is so important, so having that option available. And the second is, I know this was issued just a couple days ago, that would the agency be open to additional comments around the administrative process? You detailed a lot of, I think, very helpful information, and whether FDA is open to some two additional comments on how to support that process, really some of the details that you've talked about today under the commitment. So.
Yeah, well, of course, FDA always accepts feedback. So we don't pretend to get everything 100% right all the time. Well, I may, but my colleagues don't. Yeah, if people have comments on the guidance or something can be clearer or it's not understandable, or maybe we got something wrong, I don't think so, because it follows our internal processes, and that's what this is about. But if there's issues or questions, or certainly if we can present things clearer, that would be helpful information to have.
And on the other one, in terms of the company going through that the option is always retained for a dual submission, understanding that it can be challenging, that process. And companies are, maybe in your experience, but on my end here, they're very cognizant that the requirements are distinct, but really trying to support the efficiency in the process. So.
Yeah, well, eventually, I mean, if we end up being able to create a dual submission that everything is done with one study rather than separate studies for FDA versus CLIA waiver, that would be the ideal to do that. So I think there's lots of merit to trying it and seeing where we can get. But I think it's going to be some. I think it will be trial and error. And I think it's so far companies have found it very difficult. And so I think that's why the pre-submission is really important, so that we can help out as much as we can. You guys don't have a lot of industry doesn't have a lot of experience with it, and neither do we. So working through those problems and issues together is probably, if we expect this to become a bigger part of the program, then we'll need those interactions up front.
Thank you.
And the next question comes from Jan. Sir, your line is open.
Hi, Don. Quick question. The previous version of the CLIA administrative guidance had a table that showed needed content for categorization requests for various situations. Things such as, say, an exempt or a test system for replacement reagent. And it looks like the current version eliminated that table. I think all it says is just include the labeling. Should the sponsor follow what had previously been in there for content in the earlier version, or just include an insert?
So, I mean, when we do our categorizations, we base the categorizations on the package insert. So that's how we get our number system. The table?
Yeah, the table in the former version says, for example, like for the replacement reagent policy, anything being submitted should have a package insert that's identified for CLIA categorization and reference the original 510K number, including classification, regulation numbers, classification, product codes, et cetera, that specific information. And it looks like the new version just says, you know, a request including the labeling. So that's what we're wondering, is if all that information should still be included in the request, the specifics?
I may have to get back to you on that. I don't think taking that table out meant to change anything in the guidance document.
Okay.
I think it was just we were trying to make it simpler.
Okay.
And a lot of the things with the replacement reagent, when people use that, that's where a lot of these, the issue of making multiple changes to multiple products, which is why we've now used that Excel spreadsheet to make those types of changes.
Okay.
So, because a lot of those changes happen through the replacement reagent policy, and so we don't actually see a lot of those changes and things. So I think we may have just moved over from what was presented there to having the spreadsheet, but I'm not sure that that's the complete answer to your question.
Okay.
If the stuff you've submitted before, if you submitted if we're not trying to change any of those requirements, so if you submitted it before and you submit it now, you should be okay.
Okay.
Most of what we were talking about today is the different processes that we're using internally and what you can see from us. It's not we're not intending people to actually do anything different.
Thank you very much.
And the last question comes from Ms. Kim. Ma'am, your line is open.
Okay. We submitted the pre-IDE last year for the product to be applied for CLIA waiver. And then in the middle of time of FDA's review, FDA system has been changed as pre-submission. So in the middle of review, we received the Q number, pre-submission number. So we can use that pre-submission for the apply of dual submission here because we did the pre-submission last year.
So it's not. I'm not clear whether your pre-submission is just for a CLIA waiver. So if your pre-submission was for a CLIA waiver, and then we changed our system and we have provided Q numbers for those pre-submissions instead of I numbers, then that has no impact. So your CLIA waiver, that information is all still relevant. It's just a changing tracking system. You don't have to do anything new or different. If you're saying that pre-submission was intended for a dual 510K and CLIA waiver application submission, was that what it was for, or just for your waiver studies?
That is for both, for 510K and the CLIA waiver.
So if it was ended, if you didn't, so I would just, well, if I were you, I'd cover my bases. I would send an email to the reviewer and say, you know, just want to confirm that pre-submission is my pre-submission for my future dual submission, so that they know.
During the review process, there was a conversation with the FDA, and then FDA told us, you know, to the 510K first, and then going to the CLIA waiver at the time.
So, well, if that's not what you wanted, that's what most people do.
Mm-hmm.
So people get their FDA decision so that their product is legally marketed, and then we do the CLIA piece because the FDA has to do CLIA based on legally marketed products. The only time that we don't do that now is with this dual submission. So... if you identified your product as a dual submission and you told FDA that you were going to come in with a 510K and a CLIA waiver at the same time, if they could provide you advice to say probably not a good idea with what you're doing based on the information that you've submitted, you'd be better off doing this other way. So they could provide that as advice to you based on what you've submitted to them. But if that's not the advice you want, you just say, no, I want to do the dual submission, so I want you to review it in the context of that dual submission. So, and FDA will do that. The only time FDA would give you the other advice is if they think, wow, it's really, based on what I'm seeing, they're not going to be successful. So... they might give you other advice to at least try to help you be successful, at least on the FDA part, and then work separately on the CLIA part. So they could do that because they're looking out, you know, based on what you've submitted, whether you because, again, some people submit their applications thinking that their SCE studies will cover their CLIA waiver, and that's just not the case. They're two different statutory requirements that companies have to meet. So if a company did not understand the nuances of those two programs and said, I want to do the dual, well, everybody would say they want to do a dual because it sounds better. I can get two answers for the price of one. Well, it may sound good, but it's so much more work than doing... you know, than doing one, getting your FDA decision, because your FDA threshold is a lot lower. There's a lot less burdensome than your CLIA threshold. So it's much easier to get a substantial equivalence determination than it is to get a CLIA waiver decision based on the statutory criteria. So it really kind of, I mean, I would say I don't think their advice, if I were you, I would go back to them to try to understand what their advice was, because you have every right to do to request a dual submission, and they should be reviewing it in that context. Again, the only reason they would try to steer you away from it is if they really think that you're so far away, you're going to end up getting neither. So, but their job is actually to try to help you as best as they can to make it successful.
Thank you.
Okay.
And there are no more questions holding on the phone.
So we just had somebody look up that table question, so I'm going to come back to the previous question about the table from the guidance.
Hi, yes, I found the old version of the guidance in the table you were referencing, and most of the things outlined in that table call for additional copies of the package inserts. This was prior to us having e-copies for 510Ks and CMAs, and so we needed an extra copy of the package insert for us to use for the CLIA categorization process. We no longer need that extra copy because 510Ks and CMAs, if any marketing submission has an e-copy, so we're just going to use that same e-copy that we review for the 510K or whatever. We're going to use that to do our CLIA categorization piece. And the replacement reagent example falls under the case where you would be asking for a new categorization letter based on based on a change to your existing labeling, and that's where you would send in the new labeling and request CLIA categorization in that submission.
So hopefully that answered the question. So it's I think we're good.
Okay. Now, again, I thank you for your questions today. Please remember that this presentation will be available on the CDRH Learn section of FDA.gov. The written transcript will take a couple days, but should be posted no later than Friday, March 21st. If you have further questions, please use the contact information provided at the end of the slide presentation. And as always, we appreciate your feedback on today's presentation and on CDRH Learn in general. Thank you for participating, and this concludes today's webinar.
Your conference call has ended, and you may disconnect at this time. Again, you may disconnect. Your conference call has ended.